The best moments in our lives are not the passive, receptive, relaxing times. Although such experiences can also be enjoyable if we have worked hard to attain them, the best moments usually occur when a person's body or mind is stretched to its limits in a voluntary effort to accomplish something difficult and worthwhile. Optimal experience is thus something that we can make happen.
Welcome to the Thriveology Lab podcast, where we explore the science, philosophy, and practice of thriving. Our goal is to help you create a happier and healthier life through education, application, and transformation. Your co-hosts on this journey are Phil Dunwoody, that's me.
And Neil Lutterbach, that's me. Phil and I are both on the faculty at Juniata College, where we teach courses to promote human thriving and well-being. Before we get started, Phil, where can folks find us?
They can find the Thriveology Lab podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube. We'll be sure to respond. Follow us on Instagram, Facebook, and LinkedIn. And send questions to thriveologylab@gmail.com.
So the opening quote is from Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi's book, Flow, The Psychology of Optimal Experience. So in today's episode, we're going to talk about flow, what it is, how to achieve it, and why that would be beneficial to thriving. So looking at a little bit of sort of a very brief dive in sort of the history of it, the idea is coined by Csikszentmihalyi, but really begins with a number of predicates. One of them is Abraham Maslow's peak experiences. You might know Maslow from his sort of hierarchy of needs, which is sort of ubiquitous and famous.
Classic.
In the 1960s, Maslow was also looking at these moments that he was noticing in people who he sort of talks about, sort of people who were otherwise sane and grounded were having these moments that were borderline mystical, moments of, in his words, of great awe, moments of the most intense happiness or even rapture, ecstasy, or bliss. And these moments ranged from a common experience, well, maybe not so common, like a baby being born or profound experiences in nature. And, you know, Phil and I talked about awe in nature and how beneficial that was. And so he called these moments peak experiences. And one of his quotes here from an article, Lessons from the Peak Experiences, he writes, "There is considerable overlap between characteristics of peak experiences and the characteristics of psychological health, more integrated, more alive, more individual, less inhibited, et cetera, et cetera." So he was identifying these characteristics, but didn't really quantify them in any real substantial way. About a decade later, Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi comes along, and he's looking at play initially, and what he was noticing in participants in play was when people, this could be board games or sports, we're going to sort of point to sports probably a couple times frequently, but when people were really deeply engaged, there was this sort of common feature of sort of a merging of awareness and action, that people were sort of getting lost in this experience, and that getting lost in that moment wasn't sort of an autopilot, but was a deeply engaged experience. And so he kept digging into that, and he eventually came to identify this or name this flow, and he came up with a whole list of criteria for that. So Phil, can you tell us what is flow?
Yeah, so in researching this episode, it was fun to go back. To go back and reread the book Flow by Csikszentmihalyi. So I read it in graduate school. It was first published in 1990, and it really is a classic in psychology. And Csikszentmihalyi had published journal articles, but Flow, popular press book, really interesting to read. And he talks a lot in it about order in consciousness, which I find really interesting, in that so much of our lives are spent splintered and disordered. You know, when you're trying to do one thing, and then you think of something else you have to do, and then your phone pings, And this is basically being pulled in so many different directions. Mm-hmm. He talks about disorder, right? So I'm doing one thing, I maybe work, but I'm thinking about something else. Maybe I'm wishing I was somewhere else. And ordering consciousness, he argues, is what makes the flow experience so attractive. So flow is, this is what we experience as being in the zone, right? It's a mental state of deep absorption and engagement where individual feels a sense of effortless action and joy. There's a loss of self. It's characterized by this intense focus, sense of control, loss of self-consciousness, and some altered sense of time. So we have heightened engagement in activity. We tend to see these in tasks where there is a skill requirement. Mm-hmm. This is something we've worked at. One of the most common tasks people describe as leading to a flow experience is reading. Now, this was interesting. At first, I was like, well, what kind of skill is involved in reading? But there's actually a lot, right? When we don't think about it because we read a lot. But when you started out, it was very, very difficult. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until you really became an expert reader that you could get lost in a story. And that's because then you have the skill to meet the task demands. But if you read something that is kind of way above your zone, if you will, mm-hmm. in either subject matter expertise or vocabulary, it's not a flow state then, mm-hmm. right? It is this, it's difficult, it's challenging.
Well, and that concentration component is such a skill that we can develop. We've talked about that through mindfulness and other practice. And we see that with students who, 18-year-olds coming to us in 2025, don't necessarily, as a cohort, read a lot. And so they find reading very challenging to focus and concentrate for the long period of time it requires to read a chapter or what have you.
Yeah, and we've seen a decline in the attentional capacity, mm-hmm. the ability of adolescents, emerging adults to sustain their attention. And this is likely linked to smartphones and kind of the way that TikTok and Instagram, the quickness with which you mm-hmm. scroll through things. If flow requires prolonged engagement in an activity that is attention absorbing, but you don't have the ability to sustain your attention, it may be that you are less likely to experience mm-hmm. flow, less likely to experience that coherence in consciousness, certainly with regard to things like reading, right, which is very much a sustained attention task. So you can think of flow as this, when you're doing something that you just get lost in. It's sometimes it feels like, you might be doing something for an hour and it feels like 30 seconds, or you might be doing something for 30 seconds and it feels like an hour. There's some kind of distorted sense of time. And while you're doing it, the demands of the task are so equally matched with your skills, with your capacity, that you've got no room to think about anything else. Mm-hmm. So this is where kind of this loss of self-critical thinking comes in. We talked in the mindfulness podcast about the default mode network, right? When given nothing to do, people think about themselves, right? And they run all these mental simulations about conversations they could have, and they have mm-hmm. doubts, and they have anxiety, and we know that regular mindfulness decreases this default mode activity. Well, when you're doing something that is demanding enough that it absorbs all your attention, there is no room to think about these other things. This is part of what people like about the flow experience, whether it's surfing or skiing or reading or playing basketball or knitting mm-hmm. or, pick your thing, playing music. So they have characteristics, this heightened sense of engagement and enjoyment, intense focus and concentration, right? The task has to be demanding enough to really require this absorption. If the task is too easy, you might be bored and have room to think about other things. So the intense
and if
focus,
it's too great, you might feel overwhelmed.
Yes,
so it's
exactly.
That sweet spot. Yeah,
there definitely is a sweet spot. So feeling of control. This is something else Csikszentmihalyi talks about a bit. Is that we like to feel good about ourselves. We like to feel self-efficacy, that we can actually accomplish things, that we have power in the world. Nobody likes to feel out of control. It's anxiety provoking. Right. So when you're doing something that, again, your skill is matched with the task demands, and it's just like you're having to use all of your attention, all of your skill, but yet you're in the zone, you're doing these things, you're climbing that rock wall, you're surfing that wave. That feeling of control is lovely. It's a feeling of mastery, and we all love that.
And I would say also, I didn't have time to sort of look. I wonder, I'm thinking about it right now as you're talking, and like I think about sports and thinking about like we enjoy watching sports when two competitors or two teams are equally matched or one team is just a little bit better, so there's an underdog. But if one team is completely just outmatched and it's just a slaughter, it's not fun to watch. Yeah. And if they're both not very good, it's also not – so even just not only doing the thing – but watching that, where that is happening and getting caught up. And I know we're not covering it necessarily in this. We're talking about sort of team flow and how that can sort of – we talked about sort of emotional contagion and how that flow or that experience can extend to a group. But I think, you know, looking at like how those common experiences of even watching sport happen and getting caught up in that when that's happening.
Mm-hmm. Right. That doing the activity, one of the things that is really absorbing in these activities is this clear sense of feedback, right? So if you, if you're paddling and you pop up on the wave and you biff, the feedback is very clear. You didn't get it.
Yep.
Right? The wave got you instead.
The ocean is a very good coach.
It is. And this is part of, we like environments where we get immediate feedback that the things we're doing are good and right. We struggle a little bit in environments where the feedback is unambiguous because we generally want to do a good job. We want a sense of accomplishment. And without feedback, how do we know that? Mm-hmm. Right. So these are environments we tend to think of as immediate feedback environments, right? You're rock climbing, you go for that hold and you either get it or you don't. All right. And these tasks tend to be these flow activities because they give us this sense of self-efficacy, this sense of control. They're intrinsically motivating. We tend to seek them out. And so different people have different ways that they feel these things, right? Mm-hmm. So you might be a knitter and that's what you go to. You know, I just finished book 5 of Game of Thrones and I so enjoyed reading that. And, you know, it was my evening flow state before going to sleep. And now I don't know what to do, Neil. I'm like, oh, my gosh.
Right, George.
Book 6? And it ends in a horrible place in the story. So, but, you know, my dad is a ski instructor and a total ski nut, right? And that is probably where, more than any place else, where he experiences this flow state. And I know you love your surfing, and that's where you experience that sense. And for me, music is a big part of that, because I just feel like I get lost in the music and everything else in the world disappears and there's nothing. I'd say there's nothing but me and the music, but even that implies separation, right? And even that seems to go away because you are, you know, to be Jedi about it or Zen, you are one with the music or you're one with the slope or you're one with the wave.
Well, and where we would have gotten those ideas as human beings in the first place was this capacity for this fusion, this merging of action and awareness that becomes this oneness that is intrinsically satisfying to us.
Yeah, absolutely. So what conditions do we need to experience flow? I think we've touched on some of them a little bit, but if we're going to look for activities that might, you know, you can't, flow is one of those things that you can't say, oh, I'm going to go into flow now.
Right.
You have to be doing something else.
Wouldn't that be great?
The byproduct of flow. So what activities should we look for?
Well, again, I think, you know, you touched on a lot of those, like that clear and immediate feedback. And we've talked about this also in regards to stress response, that, you know, we evolved in the wild where there was very real feedback from the natural environment. It either was or wasn't a saber-toothed tiger, you know, and you found out real quick. And now sometimes that feedback isn't satisfying, or we don't know what to do with it, so we feel like this stagnant. And that focus and concentration, and like you said, you know, how do we cultivate more focus and concentration? We're going to talk a little later about why that is going to be important to get us into the flow, this sense of control. And it's also this, you know, typically, although I'm going to give a somewhat caveat to this in a second, but like typically there are things that, you know, you enjoy or are curious about initially. There's some spark that gets you through a hurdle to get into that flow state. Typically, we don't see that thing occur if there's pronounced resistance or just I'm not going to enjoy this. Whatever it is, I'm just not going to do it. It's going to be hard for you to shift into that flow state because the mindset at the outset is already preventative to that.
Yeah. Csikszentmihalyi talks a lot about learning as flow experiences, and that we are intrinsically motivated. You watch children at play, young kids, and they are learning machines. They just go about exploring their world. And what a disservice we do sometimes in the education system, where we turn that all into extrinsic. You know, why are you doing this? Well, because I need a grade, and I need the grade to get the degree, which I need to get, you know, the job, which will pay for my house and boat, and then I'll be happy.
Yep.
And that really can rob the joy of learning that we actually naturally have. And he talks about scientists and poets and musicians, and they pursue all of these things because they enjoy the experience, because it provides order in consciousness, this coherence. They are things that we are intrinsically motivated to do.
Well, and you and I have talked extensively about that offline, and about our students. And I'm actually preparing, we do like these orientations over the summer, and I'm preparing a talk for parents and talking about the difference between sort of product and process. Like when you are product oriented, that the learning is often less fun. And I would say related to this, you're probably less likely to find yourself in a flow, because there's always like, you know, flow is very much about the now. It's about engrossed in the moment right now. What am I doing right now? And I'm so focused on this thing that I'm less concerned about me or the outcome or any of that. We see that in sport. Like I think about like Nick Saban, the Alabama coach, talks about the process. It's like this play, this moment right now. Don't think about the championship. Don't think about winning. Think about this moment. And when you're really engrossed in playing the guitar or surfing or whatever, there isn't an outcome at your mind. It's just right now. It's this note, this moment. And that, again, you may notice a theme developing. This is also where mindfulness comes in to help us cultivate that cognitive muscle. Well, we were going to talk about like a flow in our lives. Where do you experience? Well, you've talked a little bit about, but where can you, like, moments that you identify as flow moments for you? Or
yeah, it was interesting to reflect on that as I was reading Csikszentmihalyi's classic book again. He talks about martial arts and meditation, both things that are important in my life. He talks about music, and he talks about physical activities. And you know, I used to do a whole lot of biking, and you know, when the trail challenge, you can control your speed on a trail, right? And so if you're going really slow, it may not seem challenging. If you're going really, really fast, it may actually scare the crap out of you and be dangerous.
Right.
Somewhere in the middle is that flow state where you're kind of you're at the edge of your ability, but you're still there. Right? And I find even jogging on trails outside where you have to watch your footwork like this, right? Because you have to be really in the zone. That's different than running, for me anyway, on a road, even if it's a dirt road or something, where, yeah, I can get lost in my breathing and whatnot, but it's not as absorbing as like having to watch my footwork, you know, each foot that I place down, because I don't want to twist my ankle. I don't want to trip over something.
And it speaks to that feedback, like it's,
exactly. Right, it,
yeah. This is a rock. This is a twig. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Ouch! That was a rock.
Don't do that again.
and music is definitely one of my big ones. That's one something I do most evenings before I go to sleep. At some point in the evening, I'm playing music, and it is this immediate feedback in that you play something and it sounds good, and if it doesn't sound good, you know, you're like, oh yeah, that note didn't really work. Let me try that again. And this is where it feeds into the deliberate practice part. Is that you pick something that isn't flowing in a way, that isn't working, and you drill it until it becomes smooth, until you can play it and kind of get lost in it. Mm-hmm. How about you? I know I'm going to guess surfing is one,
yeah,
but I know that's not the only one for you.
No, yeah, and you know, in thinking about that question as well, I found this work by Johannes Keller where his 2012 paper, The Flow Model Revisited, and he differentiates, he talks about flow being on this spectrum, that it's not just a single experience, but might be on this continuum. So he talks specifically about microflow and deep flow. And, you know, in thinking about that, microflow is sort of a lighter version. It's momentary experiences of this sort of focus and engagement. It's a little bit, you can find it in doodling. I found it just the other day. I had been procrastinating. We'll talk about procrastinating in a second, about a couple things. And I finally just said, you know what, I'm just going to do them. And when I just sort of decided to focus and get into it, I sort of got lost. I was just like, boom, 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 boom. And I found myself saying like, oh, I'm just knocking things out, air quotes. I'm just knocking it out. And that feeling of just knocking it out where everything just feels a little bit effortless, like I'm firing on all cylinders, I would call sort of a micro flow. Like I didn't lose, you know, a sense. Time wasn't really distorted per se. I wasn't really lost, you know, but I was really just firing.
You're in the zone.
I was in the zone.
At some level, right? And that's a good way to think about this too, is, you know, is it really a dichotomy? You're in flow or you're out of flow, or is there really more of a continuum between these?
Yeah. And then there's this deep flow he talks about, which is, I think, is what we often refer to and what we sort of described earlier. This deep is this full blown, full immersion, like, you know, and I would say if I read this material, I've probably only experienced deep flow a handful of times in my life. Okay. And so much that there was a time my first year in graduate school, I was doing that fall, I was doing Hamlet, and there was a moment in performance where I didn't lose consciousness in that I didn't know what was happening, which I think is different. It's not like I blacked out, but it was this sort of almost out of body experience. It was almost like I zoomed out and was watching myself do it. And it just seemed like everything was clicking. It seemed like it was me, like I was Polonius, like, and you know, not that audience reaction is the barometer we should always be using, but everybody after that performance was like, oh, that was amazing, blah, 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 blah. It's like, what they, I think, were responding to was this noticing a human being in this deep flow.
I think that's actually a key. We talk about it as peak experience, which it is, but it also tends to lead to peak performance.
Yeah, it's great,
right?
Yep.
So when you're because you are literally at the limits of what you're doing, skill wise, and so it is this moment of not only peak experience but often peak performance. And this is why we like to see athletes,
right?
You know, incredible athletes play and do their thing, because they're clearly in the zone, and it's just amazing to watch what they can do while they're there, right?
Yeah.
This is, again, I think true of musicians, and you know, when you're observing that, right? Okay, so there are some clear benefits of flow, right? One of them is that the more often you experience flow, the happier you tend to be in your life on a regular basis. You have higher well-being. And this makes sense. So building in, you know, we can sometimes when we think that adulting means letting go of everything that's fun. Mm. And that, you know, that's just a really bad way to look at it. Whether it's a hobby or something you're doing at work, it should be something you're very intrinsically interested in. Hopefully that gets you into that flow state. Csikszentmihalyi has a chapter on Flow at Work, in that classic book from 1990. There's a much more recent book that I use in the organizational psychology class that I teach, where he also has a chapter in there about flow experiences at work. And so similarly at work, when you're engrossed in something and you lose yourself and you're really enjoying it, you're finding it intrinsically motivating, you know, again, maybe it's not this deepest sense of flow, but it is a flow state. Mm-hmm. And I think about sometimes in certain classroom experiences, I've had that. I actually really enjoy prepping for class and organizing materials, mm-hmm. and thinking about how to kind of craft the activities in the class.
I'm working on a new class right now, and I'm doing all this research around stuff, and I'm doing syllabi, and like, I'm just imagining what it looks like. It's a lot of work, and it's really fun to do.
Yeah, exactly. And this gets to why flow at work is actually what you want is a good thing, mm-hmm. because it results in increased productivity, efficiency, and quality of people's output. So enhanced creativity and innovation come out of this, improved performance, greater job satisfaction. Right. If you're having flow experiences at work, you're happier in your job. If you're having flow experiences in your life, you're happier with your life. Reduced stress and anxiety. Mm-hmm. This kind of deactivation of that default mode network, plus the increased sense of self-efficacy. We're all motivated to. We want to feel good about ourselves. We want to feel like we're accomplishing things, and that we have value, that we have worth. Right, and some of that certainly comes from social feedback, but some of that comes from our ability to perform things and to feel certain things. And so these are things we get out of this flow state that are all really, really healthy psychological things.
So we could talk about also this, you know, how we're talking about how do we get into flow? What are the stages here? And we can point to what Stephen Kotler refers to as the flow cycle. And Kotler, one of my all-time favorite authors, his book Art of Impossible, and just go check him out. We're hoping to get him on the podcast. Stephen, if you're listening, please come. he's also the co-founder of the Flow Research Collective. And the Flow Research Collective works with all kinds of people, particularly sort of CEOs and business leaders, but also coaches and just all kinds of people. They have divided this stages or cycle into four parts: struggle, release, flow, and recovery. And I'm going to linger on this struggle component because I think to your earlier point, Phil, like it's the struggle component that people often get trapped in and don't go through mm-hmm. to get to the flow state. So they might not experience it as often as they could. And you and I talked about the other day, like we both run. You know, sometimes when you go often, I think for me always, when I go for a run, the first mile, it doesn't matter how fit I am, that first mile is a struggle.
Yes.
There's a little voice in my head that says, just stop. Go back and watch cartoons. It'll be better, right?
Yep.
And but once you get past that, if you can get past that, there's a point at which it starts to become easier. You settle in. And then if you're lucky and you're really focused on your breathing, on your steps, you're really focused and engaged and not just letting the mind drift away, although there is a point where that can happen as well. When you're really engrossed in the run, you get lost in that. It becomes this flow experience.
I think this sense of struggle is an important one because, again, we're talking about all things that require skill.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And skill doesn't come without struggle.
Mm-hmm.
All right. So I have been working, you know, I've played music for a really long time, but I've never been, my sight reading skills have never been good. And so I've been working on sight reading. And boy, talk about struggle. It is so much more fun just to play for me. And I'm now getting to the point where, at least on basic pieces, I'm starting to feel some flow reading. And it's really wonderful. But there's a lot of struggle preceding that.
Yeah. And that, you know, we talked earlier about sort of the importance of doing hard things. And I think the more you can engage that struggle with curiosity and compassion, the more that easier, quote, it becomes because you're more used to engaging with that difficulty. And one of the things that Kotler and his partner Ryan Doris talk about is this, you know, it's the struggle component leading into flow is sort of like a clock. And you have to go through the clock consistently with focus and concentration to get through it. And what we, you know, we talked earlier about the distractions, the disorderedness of the mind. When, you know, our students don't like reading, if they're reading and then 5 minutes into it, when it starts getting hard, they check Instagram and they go check email. That resets the clock, so you have to start the struggle over. So you're constantly in this struggle loop where you never get to this enjoying optimal state of flow. But if you can, if you can stick with it, stay focused on that struggle, there's a point that they call the release. And unlike the distraction, this is like this momentary suspension where all of the work sort of coalesces. It's a letting off the throttle so you can sort of incubate all the either the stuff you've taken in or the work you've already thus done. It's usually in the sort of 5 to 10 minute. It's sort of like daydreaming a little bit, but it's focused daydream. It's not just drifting off into distraction, but you're sort of mulling over the stuff you've already done. And that can be physical, that can be cognitive, like you said, the reading. You know, I think about reading when you're reading maybe a chapter and then you sort of step away from the book and you sort of picture all of the images, the Lannisters, and you start picturing like the dragons, and like you start coalescing the information in your mind, and then you go back into the work and suddenly the work catapults you into this flow state. And again, as we've already sort of talked about, all those conditions can happen. And also, like, you know, I want to be clear, I don't think Keller, or I think we are saying that this sort of light flow or deep flow is that they're good or bad or better or worse. Like, it's all flow. You just may experience it in different ways along that continuum. And then they talk about this final recovery phase, which, just like exercise, you need this sort of repair time, cognitive or physical or whatever, such that your body, and this is all the things we've talked about in terms of like mindfulness, sleep, all the things that an athlete would use to recover for the next hard bout that gets you through the struggle, that gets you into the release, that gets you into the recovery or the flow to get you into recovery.
So, yeah, I think of I also think of after doing some activity, some flow-like activity, just how at peace I often feel. There's a sense of centeredness and calmness in this, what I guess they would call this recovery phase, that I don't always have with me on a regular basis.
Right.
I would like
right.
to.
They actually call it sort of the flow afterglow.
Yes.
That sort of enjoyment. I also think, like, those days, we talk about it a little differently, but I think it's related. We, you know, when we go to Costa Rica and we're going through all these activities and everything, we have this happy tired. This flow afterglow is sort of a happy tired. Like, wow, I just really did it. I went through a thing. I did a thing that was incredible. Let me just sort of enjoy this and, you know, just settle the body, rest and recover.
Yeah, and it does seem like in that period there's still this, kind of connecting it with what we've been talking about, that this deactivation of the default mode network. I'm just being, even though I'm not doing the task anymore. I've also not gone back to what might be my normal state of thinking about what I have to do tomorrow and this thing I have to do tonight and, you know, all my big to-do list. Mm-hmm. You're still free, if you will, from these other experiences and in this glow.
Yeah, and just thinking about that struggle, it reminded me of the work of Stephen Pressfield, an author, his book War of Art. He talks about like all of the things that sort of prevent us. He's talking about it a little differently, but I see the connection here. He talks about all these things that paralyze us, the fear, the apprehension, that prevent us from going into the struggle. And like I talked about sort of procrastination. In my natural state, I'm a chronic procrastinator. Mm-hmm. And I have to put things in my way, like calendars and all kinds of rituals and things, to be external obstacles for me to overcome. Because otherwise, left to my own worst instincts, I'll just procrastinate. But that procrastination is what he just calls resistance. And resistance is all of those things, that's the self-talk or whatever, it's the distractions, or what Csikszentmihalyi might call the sort of disordered mind, that prevents us from going through the struggle, even starting the struggle. So using that sort of run analogy, the resistance is like, oh, it's cold, it's wet, I don't want to put on the shoes, it's too hard to dig out my running clothes, I'll just not do it, right? And whatever it is that we can just get over that initial hump and get through the struggle of that first mile, literally or metaphorically, is going to ultimately improve our well-being, because it's going to improve the odds of us getting into that flow state.
Yeah, and you know, we have an episode called Do Hard Things.
Right.
And it is specifically about the benefit of overcoming, you know, that sense of avoidance and resistance. This is exactly the reading music thing, because when I set this goal for myself, I would be doing it for a minute, and then I'm like, oh, wait a minute, I'm just playing now. I'm totally not even, because it was difficult, mm-hmm. and my brain naturally went to something that was more fun. Mm-hmm. And I had to stop myself from noodling, we call it, and say, okay, when I sit down, the first thing I'm going to do is 20 minutes of sight reading, and that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah.
Right? I'm going to stop avoiding. I'm going to push through that resistance. And this gets us to really what we call deliberate practice, right? So again, the flow experience is this match, or results in conditions where there's this match between the demands of the task and your skill level. Well, how do you up your skill level, right? Mm-hmm. So that you don't feel, let's say you're new to surfing. I mean, every year we take students surfing who've never been surfing. And so their skill level is basically zero at the start. But what do? Even before we go to Costa Rica, we practice pop-ups, which is essentially how you get up on the board, right? So you can practice that without the board. We practice that to try and get it more automatic. And this is a form of deliberate practice. So deliberate practice is how you up your skill level so that you're more likely to feel flow in a particular task. And it's how you get better at any given task. We like to play at things, which is good, but sometimes we don't always enjoy the deliberate practice that really makes us better. So there'll be, you know, again, I'm using a lot of music analogies because I think this is a really good one, but if you've played an instrument for 5-10 years and you're not really any better, it's probably because you're not engaging in deliberate practice. You're just existing within your current skill zone, and you're not focused on your weaknesses. So this concept came from Anders Ericsson, a psychologist, who referred to highly structured, individualized training activities designed to improve specific aspects of an individual's performance through focused effort, feedback, repeated refinement. It is goal-oriented and specific. Deliberate practice really is about, okay, this is the thing I am not doing well. Let me break it down into its components, and let me practice those components, and then let me put it back together, and then practice it again. And this continued process, you know, again, as a Tai Chi teacher, this is something that I enjoy about Tai Chi as kind of a lifelong practice, because I can always be refining my movement. Mm-hmm. I can always be working on deliberate practice to increase my skill.
I think that's really important, because like the obstacle is going to potentially always increase. As you get better, the obstacle is always keeping that obstacle, that goalpost, just a little outside, and your skill level increases incrementally with, and keeping that going requires that you, so we're talking about the surfing, like just going surfing isn't necessarily going to make my surfing better. But if I drill and drill and drill and repeat the pop-up and correct the micro mistakes, oh, my foot was too close here, my shoulders weren't forward, like whatever it is, like you can't do that if you're only doing it a couple times. You have to repeat. And that's not necessarily fun. It's hard. It's very hard work and requires a great deal of focus to do that kind of practice.
It is, but I think there can be a joy in it, sure, as yeah, well, yeah. I think, right? This is the joy of learning to some extent.
Right.
You know, if you're if your goal is just to get a college degree and then, oh, I have the degree and now I'm done learning. Right. That is, of course, not what we want.
Right.
Right. Or, oh, I got the black belt. I no longer have to, I've learned everything I need to know about karate. Well, no, you've reached a milestone, but hopefully what you've learned along that path is how to engage in deliberate practice so that you can continue self-cultivation, continue that skill development. And this is what's going to lead you into more flow activities. And Angela Duckworth, who is coined the term grit, right, talks about kind of, you know, perseverance, your ability to stick with something. And she states that gritty people do more deliberate practice, and as a result, they experience more flow. Right. And so this is what we want. We want to work hard at activities, get better at them, develop skill, and then get this kind of optimal experience. And ideally, we want that in our workplace.
Mm-hmm.
We want it in our home life.
Well, I thought what you were saying also, again, reminding me of sort of mindfulness, thinking about that sort of beginner's mind, that you're always open to, like, how can, not that it's not product oriented, but it's process oriented. How can I improve? How can I improve this? Weakness sounds like such a negative, but like, I want to be better. I want to be better at this thing I love. And it's going to require this effortful, deliberate repetition of a given skill set such that it becomes better, such that I can take on greater challenges, such that I have to go back to the deliberate practice to work on more skills so I can take on a bigger challenge. It's this beautiful cycle. And again, to your point, like, it's that process is rewarding in and of itself. It's not, you know, a Cinco de Mayo party fun all the time, but it is enjoyable and rewarding in that pursuit of something you find rewarding.
Yeah, exactly. It builds discipline in us. It helps increase our skill level, which then makes us feel better about ourselves. We wind up then with these more kind of flow-like experiences. We've already mentioned a bunch of things that that result in this, the common things that result in flow. Csikszentmihalyi says the most common one is reading. Learning can certainly be it. For many of us, it is physical activities, sports, movement. But I know people who are really into knitting, right? And that is, for them, clearly something that can be for them yields a flow-like state, right? And this is where it is, you know, kind of your own interest level, your own skill level all come into this. So what's our challenge for people this week, Neil?
Well, apropos of your point just there, like, identify something either that you – this might take a little – we've talked about a little journaling. This might take a little journaling. Maybe notice points in your life where you have experienced flow. Identify things that you love and want to be better at, and see if you can put those experiences more in your life. Do them more often, and identify also to that deliberate practice something about it, a skill point that you can deliberately work on, and then put it on your calendar. Like, I'm going to work on my pop-up Monday, Wednesday, Friday from 9 to 9:30, and then I'm going to go surfing in August. Like, whatever that you can do more of the thing you love. See if you can make that happen for yourself.
Yeah, and it can be a simple, if reading is one of those,
board games. Yep.
Yeah. Yep. For me, reading fiction before I go to sleep in the evening, I find very relaxing. And it's a very simple way to put a flow-like activity in my daily life. All right. So that's it for this episode. Subscribe to the Thriveology Lab on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, YouTube, or wherever you get your podcasts. Leave a comment or question on YouTube, and we'll be sure to respond. Be sure to follow us on Instagram and Facebook. If you have questions or comments, please reach out to us at thriveologylab@gmail.com. Thrive on.
Thrive on, friends.